度は。
Mayor, Colonel Taft, Chief Hitt, I'm going to mention also Mr. Horsch, Mr. Kraft. It's generally common in, when you speak anytime in front of a military crowd, you mention anybody that's higher ranking or in unique positions. There's men here that knew me when I was knee-high to a grasshopper back at Hope Baptist Church, and I can't help but say their names, and I put them on general status. So it's an honor to be here, truly humbled. Kind of think you drug the bottom of the barrel on finding a hero, because there's men in this room that definitely can wear that title way more than me. But I can say that I have known some heroes, and hopefully I get to mention a few today. I wrote some notes that I'm going to try to follow. Usually if I speak in front of a crowd, it's more on the education side as an instructor. I'm kind of comfortable with that. Standing in front of a church is probably the least comfortable thing I've ever done. But once again, I'm humbled to be here. I'm going to go off script real quick. I'm going to mention something that I wasn't planning on mentioning today, but I don't know. With all the singing of the national anthem, the Vietnam veterans, it's very touched that they're posting the colors, the various patriotic songs. I've had a unique opportunity in the military that not everybody would have. There's probably an elite few that work in some special units up in Washington, D.C., and that's to do military funerals. I was working at the officer candidate school. I was a very young captain, pre-command, and I got called up to do a duty to go over to Macon, Georgia, and to actually do the honors at a military funeral. I had a Sergeant First Class Ross that was assigned with me. He was very good NCO, very quiet man. And we were preparing, and he said, "Sir, I got a problem." And I said, "What is that?" He said, "I can't present that flag, and the funeral we're going to is an enlisted member, and I'm supposed to present it for enlisted. You're supposed to present it for officer." And I said, "Why can't you?" And he said, "Because I can't present it and not cry." He said, it's an unfortunate thing. When I go to a funeral, I cry. And I said, "There's nothing, no ruleism that I know of that says an officer can't present it for an enlisted guy." So I presented it. When I went to that funeral that day, there was a lot of crying. And I presented that flag. And on the way back, I don't think he was saying it to be rude, but he said, "You're kind of heartless." He said, "I don't see how you could be stone-faced and present that flag and not have emotion." And I said, "The Army didn't pay me to come here and cry. They came here to pay me to hand a flag to somebody, and I'm going to do it to the best I can do it." But when he said that, it kind of tripped something in my mind. He basically said that you're good at doing something. So when I went back to my unit, I told the operations officer, I said, "I will volunteer to take every funeral detail that we have for this period of time." And I took them all. I took them in Macon. I took them at Valdosta. I took them over in Phoenix City. I got up to West Point when I was post command, and I ended up the operations officer for my department, DPE, Department of Physical Education, Department with a Heart, and that's what they called us. One of the duties there was to also assign other people to do those funerals, and I volunteered to take them all. I had a good friend I went to University of Georgia with, an African-American guy from inner city Philadelphia. We probably had as diverse a growing up, but he is one of the three best friends I've had in my life. When he found I volunteered, he volunteered with me. And we did funerals in Pennsylvania. We did funerals New York, New Jersey. So somewhere between the neighborhood of 40 to 50 funerals I have done. And every single one of them I have presented that flag. The most unique that I will never forget was in Fort Mitchell, Alabama. I was with Sergeant Ross. It was an NCO, and he said, "Today, I will present the flag. It's an NCO. He's a Vietnam vet, and I'm going to present the flag today." They played taps, and when you play taps, a lot of people start crying. We stood up by the casket. We got the flag, and we began to fold the flag the way you're supposed to. And I looked up. He was doing fine. The person that we were going to hand the flag to was a very large, older African-American woman. And if you've ever heard a choir in like a black church, women that can really sing, that just have that powerful voice, she had that kind of voice. And as we were folding that flag, she bellowed out as loud as she could, "Oh, Jackson, don't leave me now." And she began to cry. And I saw tears start to come down Sergeant Reese's face. And he looked at me, and I just barely nodded my head, knowing I will take the flag and I'll present it. And when I presented that flag, when you hand that flag, you say, "On behalf of the President of the United States and the people of a grateful nation, I present this flag as a token of appreciation for the honorable and faithful service your loved one rendered this great nation." And then you hand it, and you very slowly salute, and you drop the salute. She hugged me. She stood up and hugged me. She had big tears. And it just touched me. It touched me for a number of reasons. Her husband served at a time that equality wasn't so equal in America. Her husband served at a time that there were places in Phoenix City, Alabama, he couldn't go eat. And that's where I lived. But I could pay an honor back to him. And it touched me, you know, recently thinking about that, because we're at a kind of an odd time in America that it's become customary at certain events that people take a knee when we play that national anthem. And the reason I wanted to mention that is when you say that blurb, and I didn't write that blurb down, I didn't have to look at it, I know it by heart because I've done it enough times, it's burned into my memory, that the token of appreciation for the service is that flag. So you can't take a knee because it does do a disservice for those men that served. And I just wanted to mention that. It wasn't part of what I wanted to speak on today, but I think it's important. I also wanted to, there's a lot of people that say, "Thank you for your service. I really appreciate it. Don't feel I necessarily deserve it." There's a group, it's just me as an individual that I uniquely like to remember. Is there anybody in this auditorium that served that was drafted? There's some draftees. That's, to me, that's a special group. It's one thing to be, "Thank you, sir." It's one thing to say, this is the occupation I want to do. I volunteer to be a fireman, a policeman, a soldier, a marine, an airman, an officer. It's another thing that you were called up by your country. So a special thank you to you. Okay, more important than anything I can say would be to actually read something from the Bible. I don't like reading aloud in public, but I'm going to read. So we're going to go to 2 Samuel 23. I'm not going to read the entire chapter, and I'll tell you when I'm going to skip. "These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains, the same was Adino, the Ezonite. He lifted up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time. And after him, Eleazar, son of Dodo, the Ahoite, one of three mighty men with David. When they defied the Philistines, they were gathered together. Battle at the men of Israel were gone away. He rose and smote the Philistine until his hand was weary, and his hand clave unto the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned him only to spoil. And after him was the Shammah, son Agi, Harite, and the Philistines were gathered together in a troop. It was a piece of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it, and he slew the Philistine, and the Lord wrought a great victory." I'm going to jump down to verse 15. "And David longed and said, Oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. And the three mighty men brake the host of the Philistines and drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would drink therefore, but poured it out unto the Lord. And he said, Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Not the blood of men went into jeopardy for their lives. Therefore, he would not drink these things, did the three mighty men. And Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of, I can't say his name, was chief among the three. And he lifted up his spear against 300, and he slew them and had name among the three. He was not most honorable of the three. Was he not most honorable of three? Therefore, was he their captain. Howbeit, he attained not unto the first three." This is one of my favorites. "And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man, Jezebel, who had done many acts. He slew two lion-like men of Moab. He went down also. He slew a lion in the midst of a pit in a time of snow. And he slew an Egyptian, a goodly man. And the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, and he went down unto him with a staff. And he plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, and he slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had the name among the three mighty men. And he was more honorable than the 30, but he attained not to the first three. And David set him over the guard. Now, the next, you have a whole lot of list of names. I find it interesting that they're each listed in groups of two. I find that interesting because in the Army, we're very much taught you always have a battle buddy. You always have a ranger buddy. But the very last verse, I'm going to go down to Uriah the Hittite, 37 in all. I'm going to back up real quick before I discuss this to probably about 1972. I was somewhere between the ages of 3 and 4. I lived at my mom's mother's house. My family lived there. And I distinctly remember my mom coming to me and said, "Tonight, you're going to church." The word church had no meaning to me. I did not know what church was. I had never heard the word. I had no idea where I was going. But I remember my dad brought a book, small book, had a picture of a man with longer hair. He was sitting on a rock, and there were sheep and children around. It was a picture of Jesus on a small Bible. I had no idea what a Bible was, had never heard of a Bible that I can remember of. And I went to church. It was Hope Baptist. It was actually my grandma Pudell took me to an event. It was a vacation Bible school. And the man that spoke at the vacation Bible school went by the moniker Uncle Fran the Bible Man. Does anybody here remember Uncle Fran the Bible Man? He's a very unique part of my history. To my memory of thinking back, and I went to Jackson Baptist School. He was a common speaker on Chapel Fridays at Jackson Baptist. That he seemed to be maybe in his 50s, had jet black hair, and kind of looked and sounded like Bob Baker, Barker, the old. Am I correct on that? Am I even close? I don't know who he actually was. I assume he was a preacher that kind of preached to children. And he was a good speaker. But one thing that was unique, like I said, I was a small child, was in an auditorium. He was up speaking, and he pointed to me and made me come up front. And when he made me come up front, he was giving the story of David and Goliath. And he used me as an example of he's Goliath and I'm David, that there's this size difference. And he used that as an example to kids. So my first time going to church, I got a message that was very much warrior-centric. A small boy without armor, I think in his late teens, when nobody else would fight him, stepped on the field of battle, took a sling, took some smooth stones, walked out there and slew a giant, climbed up on him, took this giant sword and cut his head off. It's pretty pretty violent, but it's a very warrior message. Very soon after that, and like you're talking about the memory of a small child, my entire family began to go to Hope Baptist Church. My grandmother, my grandfather, I had aunts, I had uncles. We filled up a number of pews. And that church and the men of that church, the women of that church, became very much a part of my life. They're very much a part of my upbringing. I can to this day remember a message my Sunday school teacher, Forey Conley, gave on the reconnaissance mission that Joshua and Caleb, when they went in, and just thinking the awesomeness and the bravery of those men. The story of Gideon was very much a story as a child that I liked. And what I liked about Gideon is Gideon wasn't a tough guy. Gideon was not a brave guy. Gideon actually went through a series of these, I call them scientific experiments, that he was being spoken to, by an unnatural, it's not the physical, and he literally tested God, we're going to put a fleece out and there's going to be dew everywhere else and not dew on the fleece. But in the end, he led a group of volunteers, three-time volunteers. They stripped away those that weren't fit to serve, and they slew a much larger unit. So these warrior messages became very part of my upbringing. They burned themselves into my mind. Well, I can't help but tell a story about Uncle Joe. So very early in church, if you were to say, are we competitive as brothers, and that would be me, him, and our brother Jeff, it would be an understatement. We will compete in anything, and he is the most competitive of the three. Uncle Joe does not let you win. You about got to beat him down to win. I didn't like to speak in public when I was little. I had a speech impediment. I couldn't say the letter R, but I was sitting in a Sunday school class, and I can almost believe it was Connie Mann, and I thought Connie Mann was the coolest because she had a lot of freckles, and it just, when you're little, it was cool that she was freckled, but she was a good Sunday school teacher. But at some point in time, she drew a house, and it's what she said, it's a house. And I have a bad habit when I was little, I have it to this day, that from time to time, if I see something, hear something, I say what comes to my mind as it comes to my mind, without a lot of filter. And I blurted out, not trying to be a Weisenheimer, not trying to be smart alecky, that looks like a doghouse. It looked like Snoopy's doghouse. And it wasn't to get a laugh, but children started to laugh. And they laughed a little bit, and you know, wasn't the intention. Well, Joey is never to be outdone. And Uncle Joe, sitting next to me, when the laughter stopped, blurted out, it looks like dog mess to me. And he got a much bigger laugh than I did. And I ended up got a whooping after church, if I remember right, for because I was the one that started the whole thing, and Uncle Joe got one next to me. But it was probably one of many whoopings I got from the doings of Uncle Joe, that saying something inappropriate. I want to add to anybody here that teaches Sunday school, and I mentioned that the lessons that you teach a child matter, because they do. I mean, when you're talking 20 and 30 years after the fact, that you're making decisions as a grown man on a battlefield, in a command, to be able to think back on those lessons that you learned at 4, 5, 6 years old, is if you want to talk about a hero, that's a hero. Okay, back to the mighty men. I'm not a Bible scholar. I didn't go to Bible school, a Bible college, but I went to good, sound, independent, fundamental churches a good percentage of my life. I hit a period of time after I joined the Army that I was backslidden, was out of church for a number of years. But I'm Bible knowledgeable. There's not a lot in the Bible that I've read that, like, hey, huh, I didn't know that was there. But I had started going back to church when I was a captain teaching at West Point, and had a realization that I was backslidden, that I had been out of fellowship, that even though I was going to church, I wasn't praying and reading my Bible. And I committed to say, I'm going to read the Bible cover to cover, and I'm going to do it in a fairly short amount of time. And I began to read it. I began to really enjoy it. And I got to this piece of scripture. I got to this David's mighty men. And never in my life do I remember hearing that. I cannot recall one sermon on David's mighty men. I had never heard of Benaiah. And I was very, as a prior Army Ranger, as a guy that was hand-selected to go to United States Military Academy to help build a new combatives program to teach everything from Muay Thai kickboxing to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and you know, a guy that, when I say I like to fight, I don't mean fight with somebody in the Walmart parking lot, but fight in a ring, on a mat, or on a battlefield. That I read this, and I just soaked it up. And when I read it, I couldn't help but I relate everything I read, I see, I hear to something that I know personally. And I couldn't help but say that these mighty men, if you draw an equivalent to our military today, they are Delta Force. I have served with the elite. I'll tell you, one of probably the most respected groups out there are Air Force PJs. If you've ever worked with a pararescue from the Air Force, I mean, they are just the cream of the crop. I was an Army Ranger. They're a good unit. I've worked with Navy SEALs. I've worked with Marine MARSOV. Just the Marine infantryman is an elite soldier in himself. But our Army Delta Force is the tip of the spear. It's the top. It's a very small, very select, very hard unit to get into. And when you serve around them, they're the best of the best. What I consider the best friend I had in my life, a guy named Shannon McKinney, spent 15 years in Delta Force. He recently died of cancer a little over a year ago. But he is a warrior that when I read these stories, I saw Mac's face. I was like, he's a tough guy. There were a number of things. The guy that fought in the field of lentils, people fled, and he didn't flee. And he stood there with a sword, and he fought. That was impressive to me. When it talked about a guy's fighting with a sword, and he fought with a sword so long that his hand clave to it, he got a cramp in his arm and his forearm that he couldn't let the sword go. The level of mental and physical hardness it took for a man to do that is pretty amazing. When I first got into the Army, switched over to this new combatives where it started being based on ground fighting. They had the Gracie brothers bring in their Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I took it up as a hobby, And I have a habit that I do things to an extreme. And I began to do that to an extreme. I weighed about 205, and I began to fight so much. I would fight before PT. I had an NCO that worked for me that was a phenomenal athlete, phenomenal fighter. We fight everywhere. We fight in the office, fight in the parking lot. But I began to do this fighting thing. But in the early days of it, I wasn't technical. I hadn't really grasped the technique. I was physical, and I just fought hard, and I fought mean. And I came up with this wild, harebrained idea when I was an OCS instructor. I had a guy that played college football. I said, get all the tough guys, line them up. I want to see how long I can fight without stopping. So put a stopwatch. I said, you control the flow. Send a guy in. We'll grapple. If I tap him out, send a new one in. If I end up tapped out, then we're done. And I fought for 45 straight minutes without quitting, just fighting over and over, which is pretty stupid. But I did it. So I go home, face is all scuffed up. My wife would look at me like, what in the world are you doing? Because, I mean, you had blood coming out your ears, and you're just bruised and battered, and I couldn't get enough of it. But I was sitting in my Lazy Boy, and I just started hollering. And she's like, what is wrong? And my hands pulled up, and they just cramped. My forearms were cramped, so I couldn't move my hand. I had to run in and run cold water. And she had a look like, you're just an idiot. Nobody normally does that to themselves. So when I read this, I like these guys. I'm not their equivalent. I was not Delta Force. I was an Army Ranger. If they went another chapter and they had the 500, then I might would be the 500, the 1,000. But I'm not one of these guys. But I know these guys. I think I know them. I think I know a little bit the way they think, the way they operate. And I kind of ask myself, why isn't there any sermons on these guys? Or why isn't there a lot? Have you preached a sermon on these guys this year? Not yet. So, not a lot of sermons on there. And I kind of like, hey, we got to get busy and preach some sermons on the mighty men. Something that really did strike me odd is I got to the last verse. And it said, Uriah the Hittite. And that's all it said. And when I got there, I said, I know this guy. I've met this guy before. But I didn't know him necessarily so much as the warrior. That's the guy that his wife was bathing on a roof. David came out and saw her, saw that she was beautiful, brought her, had immoral relations with her, and he was brought back from the battlefield. Didn't go visit his wife, and I began to think on him. I began to contemplate that. One of the things I would say is if Uriah was called from the battlefield to come back and brief David, what rank was Uriah? He wasn't Private Uriah. You don't call a private to go from Afghanistan back to the White House and brief the commander-in-chief or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. It's at the very least going to be an 06 colonel, a smart guy like the Air Force colonel we got in here, not a dummy like me. You get smart guys, you get leaders, you get people further up in the ranks. So Uriah is a leader and he's a warrior. The other thing I kind of thought of is if David is the king, stands on the roof, and he looks out, and he can see Uriah's wife from his rooftop, how far did Uriah live from the king? Even, David's not superhuman. He's a man. Even if he had the best of eyesight, to be able to look upon a woman and say she's a very beautiful, she's a very attractive woman, I'm betting that Uriah lived within 100 yards of the king of the palace. Anybody agree, disagree? So he lives close, which he's a higher ranking. I've never met the mayor of Jackson before, but glad to have you here. If I went to his house, he's the highest ranking leadership in Jackson, and I stand on the front porch of his house, I'll bet you we have other nice houses. He achieved, the people had confidence in choosing him as a leader. That means he's achieved before. I don't think he lives in a trailer park, and I'm not knocking people that live in a trailer park. I've lived in one before. So Uriah is a man of status. He's a man of rank. He lives close to the palace, and it'll come a little later in my rambling. I'll kind of bring that back up. So when I tell you as a person that I when I read this, I kind of fell in love. This is one of the coolest chapters in the Bible to me. I just ate it up. Why? What is it about me as a human being that made that appeal to me? And I'm going to tell a few, try to make them quick, stories. And I want to preface before I say that. If I say something is unique to me, it's something I like, that does not mean it's biblical. That doesn't even mean it's right. I can tell you I like chewing Red Man tobacco, and I don't. Well, I used to years ago. Quit that. But if I said that, that doesn't mean that's a right thing because I like it. I could like something that's not good. But when I read this, one of the things I would say that very much shaped me as a very young child is football. At a very, very young age, my dad began to teach football. And when I say football was almost religion to him, it was almost religion to him. Joey can tell you. We lived not too far from Clark Lake. We lived in a farmhouse. And my mom worked as a waitress, I think, at the Coffee Manor. And at night, we would do football drills at a young age. And we had full, I'm talking age 5 and 6, we had full shoulder pads, helmets. And to my dad, football was one thing. It was hitting. And you were going to hit. I mean, it didn't matter if you were crying and there's tears and snot bubbles. You were going to hit until you hit to the level that he wanted you to hit. And if I said football was religion, then the rankingest person in that religion was none other than Dick Butkus. I mean, a little grew up, you know, you got Moses and Abraham and Dick Butkus. They were religious figures. I don't know why, but as a young age, I began to like the physical contact in football. Not everybody that I knew played football liked the actual hitting, and I absolutely loved open field tackling. And not saying this to be boastful, but when I began to play Little League football, they had an awesome recreation league here in Jackson. I could scare people. I could hit people, and I could hit them hard, and I liked that. It was something that I enjoyed doing. I liked when you hit so hard you could see a flash of white that you literally about knocked yourself out. I had that happen on a sideline on a game. I hit on a kickoff. I hit a guy just so hard that when I stood up, I had lost partial consciousness. And the first thing I remember seeing was my Uncle Glenn. And my dad had my face mask, and he was saying a lot of things, not repeatable in church. And I thought he was angry. I thought I had not wrapped up on the tackle, but I had hit so hard, the guy, he was laid out. He was 10 toes up. I still know who he was. I went to school with him later on. And he didn't play football after that. But I liked that. That's part of something unique as me, football, and it shaped me as a young age. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind that I wanted to serve in the military, but I was not of the intelligence level that I was going to get selected to go to West Point. I was not going to get an ROTC scholarship straight out of high school. I was about a 3-point GPA, fairly decent athlete, tall, skinny, and I wanted to be in the Army. I went down to the recruiters. I rode a bike down there, walked in. There was a guy who was from Alabama, African-American guy named Alfred Taylor, eating a cheeseburger, and he said, "Son, can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, I want to be a United States Army Airborne Ranger," and he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, "How many times you been arrested?" I didn't know that was a prerequisite. But I said, "None." And he said, "Well, how long ago did you quit school?" "I haven't quit school." "How many days you missed this year?" "I haven't missed a day since sixth grade." You know, I played football, was captain on the wrestling team. And he was like, "Why do you want to be a Ranger?" I took the ASVAB, had a pretty high score. He's like, "You can be logistics." And I literally, nothing against logistics. You got to have logistics. You got to have a medical corps. You got to have all these supports. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to tip of the spear. I wanted to kick doors in, shoot guns, jump out of airplanes. If America went to war, I wanted to be the first guy there. That's what I wanted to do. As part of that football, wanted to be a warrior mentality. I got to basic training in 1987. And I had the highest PT score in my platoon. I was fit. I was the only member of my platoon to be able to shoot 40 out of 40 with rifle marksmanship. I found out that two things in life I could do naturally from the start: hit people and shoot a rifle. Anything academic, I didn't do so well. But I enjoyed that. And I got to, you know, I was the honor graduate from my platoon. I got to the Ranger Regiment. I had been to the Ranger Regiment for literally 2 or 3 months. I was a buck private. You had to kind of fight your position to go to Ranger school. You'd go to the actual Ranger unit, but to go to Ranger school to get the tab to put on you, you kind of had to prove yourself. My platoon leader, Lieutenant Chris Pease, had wrestled in the Pan Am Games as a heavyweight wrestler. He was a monster of a man. He stood about 6'4", weighed about 230 pounds, and he had an enormous head. Our RTO once put his helmet on and got slapped for doing so, for making fun of him. But we got up for PT one morning. He ran us down to a little area. It was an old stone arena that had been there since World War I. It wasn't really used anymore. And he had the pugel sticks, those sticks with the pads on them and the helmets and all. And we were going to do pugel stick for PT. And it was kind of fun. I got to fight my team leader and kind of beat him up. I didn't like him. But at one time, I looked over, and Lieutenant Chris Pease was trying to pugil stick one of the squad leaders, Trip Melton. And he was the largest guy in our platoon other than Pease, and he was running from the lieutenant. And I asked the guy next to me, my roommate, I said, why is he running from platoon leader? And he said, would you fight him? I said, yeah, I'll fight him. So he hollers out, Pudell wants to fight the platoon leader, which is not exactly what I said. But so the whole platoon got in a circle, and he suited up, and I suited up, and our platoon sergeant said, go. Now, we were a pretty good separation. Well, normally, you kind of walked up and began to do the fight. I put my head down, and I ran as hard as I could, and I hit him like a linebacker, and I knocked him slightly off balance, and I began to wear him out a little bit. He kind of regained his composure. He swung, and he spun that helmet around. I was looking through the ear hole, and it felt like a stick of dynamite went off in my helmet. It about knocked me out. I mean, he cracked me. He's just a massive man. Well, I rocked back, and I was trying to get my composure. I'm trying to pull the helmet back where I can see, and he knocked the stick out of my hand. When he knocked the stick, he was still coming. I lunged forward. I got him by the face mask, and I punched him in the sternum. And when I did, he bear hugged me, took me, you know, he's a collegiate wrestler, had me on the ground, had his hand on my face, and he's got his forearm beating me. And he's like a crazed man, and his eyes look like they're on fire, and the squad leaders start pulling him off, and he came back to himself and like, oh, I'm about to kill Private Pudell here. And he reached down with these bear claw hands, and he picked me up, put his arm, and he said, this is good stuff. This is rangering. This is what rangering's all about. And we went back, ate breakfast. I was in my room. My squad leader came in. He said, there's something about you not right. He said, there's something just different about you. He goes, there's nobody in this platoon wants to fight him. He said, you just went to number one on the order of merit list for U.S. Army Ranger School. You better start getting ready. And that, I know that sounds like I'm bragging, and maybe I am, but I like the physical. I like the fight. I don't like to fight people I can beat. I like to fight people that it should be impossible for me to beat them. It's what appeals to me. So when I read this chapter, and I read about a man fighting, you know, he killed 800 people. Somebody fighting a lion, two lion-like men. Somebody fighting a lion in a pit. Those are hard, hard men. They're not normal men. They're not normal in society. That's not your average guy out there. When I think of my buddy, Shannon McKinney, he is extremely unique. He was extremely lethal, and he could kill on the battlefield. One of the other influences I would say that kind of really shaped me, we had an NCO that came to my platoon. I didn't like him when he first got there. He was half Colombian. He was from New York. He spoke with that kind of obnoxious New York accent. We had a series of where we jumped into the field. We did a 12-mile road march. We did live fires all day. We did an 8-mile road march the next day. We did live fires all day. We did 12, and we kept doing this. And we finished it with a 24-mile road march. And anything beyond 12 becomes painful. I don't care who you are. I don't care how physically fit. When you carry 50, 60 pounds on your back, a 25-pound machine, all this stuff, it's painful. And I woke up Saturday morning beat up. Everybody's beat up. Your feet hurt. I went to use the latrine, and here comes Vic Hoyos, Sergeant Hoyos, coming up the stairs, and he's got full equipment on. He's got his rucksack on, and he's covered in sweat. I said, Sergeant Hoyos, what are you doing? He said, I just did a 12-mile road march. I said, why? He said, I left my keys on top of my wall locker, so I punished myself. And I said, you're crazy. And he goes, nah, it's good for you. He said, come talk to me. And we started talking. He said, Pudell, do you ever get your boots out, sit them up, and just talk to your boots? And I said, no, I don't talk to my boots. He said, you ought to. He said, your boots take you a lot of place, and they've been a lot of place. They don't let you down. He said, you ought to talk to your boots someday. He said, but I got a piece of advice for you. He said, we've worked together for a while. He said, you're very physically fit. And he said, you're very capable. And there had been a thing that happened a couple months before that. This knucklehead decided on a weekend he was going to ride his bicycle to Panama City, Florida. I don't know how far that is, but it was over 24 hours of just solid on a bike pedaling. No team, no support. He just did it. Just kind of knucklehead he was. He's just physically hard. When he came back, we went into the field, and we jumped in. We're moving through thick terrain. It's dark, and he began to struggle. He had dehydrated himself. His body hadn't replenished, and I knew he was struggling, and I took his rucksack without even saying anything. I put it on top of mine, and I carried his rucksack for a couple hours, and I gave him my two-quart canteen, and I let him drink my water. He never forgot that. And he brought that up. He said, you can do things that other people can't physically. He said, but what you got to learn to do is love it when it's miserable. He said, when we're old men and we meet up one day, we're not going to talk about the day that the sun was shining and everything went right. We're going to talk about the day that the sleet came, the helicopters couldn't fly. Everything went bad. And Smith broke his ankle, and we had to pick his rucksack up, put it on our back, and carry it an extra 20 miles to get to wherever we're going. He said, learn to love it when it's miserable, and learn to have the look on your face where nobody can tell you hurt. And he said, when you do that, soldiers are going to look up to you. And I kind of adopted that. I tried to apply it. There's times that I had soldiers come to me when I was a platoon leader, like, wow, you know, you don't even look like this bothers you. And it bothered me as much as anybody else. It was just physically painful. You just learn to ignore it. You learn to embrace it. And I think you kind of come to a point to where you learn to love it. It's not normal. But there are people that would like that. We had a sergeant major. The story on These Mighty Men is a story on combat. And I don't want to tell a lot of combat. We had a sergeant major when I was a young private that was a Vietnam vet named Donald Purdy. And he had survived two near ambushes in Vietnam. And he was an actual living legend in the Ranger Regiment. He looked like a cross between the Marlboro Man and Freddy Krueger. He was all scarred up. He walked bow-legged. The first time I ever saw this man, it very seldom snows at Fort Benning. It had snowed this slushy stuff about this deep. I was standing outside the chow hall waiting to go in, and I heard this just god-awful racket, holler, and he comes around the corner, and he's low-crawling and high-crawling, and he's a sergeant major, and he's going through this slop. I'm like, who's this wild man? And he gets up, it's a great day to be a Ranger. And he had this saying, he said, every RIP, you had to go to a Ranger indoctrination program to get in Ranger Regiment. Every RIP student should be shot in the leg with a .22, made to do a 12-mile road march. If you pass that, you're a Ranger. You know? And I didn't half know if he was serious or, you know, he's making this stuff up. But we went to the Ranger Ball one year, and he was the guest speaker. And you're kind of like, whoa, there's going to be women here. And, I mean, this guy was rough around the edges. And he gave a very eloquent speech. And he actually said, I'm not here to speak to the Rangers. I'm here to speak to the wives, the girlfriend. I'm going to tell you about your Ranger. But at a point in time in that speech, he had talked about, you know, combat, and he said, I'm going to tell you something. Any man that will tell you he likes combat is sick. No man likes combat. And he paused. He looked down a little bit, and he said, but when the bullets start flying, I kind of like it. And I think he was serious. He was a guy that liked combat. Now, you fast forward, when I went to Panama, I had just turned 21. I'd never been to combat before in my life. You train, and it's like being on a football team. You're wanting to play a game, but you still, this is combat. It's real. I mean, it's not the video game. You don't get to reboot yourself and go back in again. Jumped in at Omar Torrijos International Airport. Shannon McKinney, the guy I talked about, Delta Force, he was my assistant gunner. And I ended up on the north end of the airport. I will say, the Air Force. I jumped from 500 feet, hit the ground. About knocked myself out on the runway, and when I looked up, it said Omar Torrijos International Airport. I said, that is the most accurate the Air Force can be. I mean, when I was supposed to drop there, I mean, almost hit the sign. But stacked up on the north side, squads went in and started room-to-room clearing. My roommate, Dave Reeves, was the first man on a three-man clearing team going in to clear a room. He got shot three times, center mass, close range. He got punched one through the shoulder, one hit the front sight post, exploded into his head, one hit his collarbone. He had a hole in him big enough you could stick your fist in. And they sent two more privates in. There were two Cuban colonel advisors. They ended up going hand-to-hand combat with one. And they were in a latrine above my head. The building went up, it came out, went back up. There was a column. Mac was right to my right. And next thing you know, one of these advisors came out the window, literally hit the ground. He was from here to the flag right there in front of me, and he got up on his hands and knees. He looked back. He saw me. He was in civilian clothes. I didn't know who he was. Is he a bad guy? Is he a good guy? Is he a civilian? Reeves is shot. There's grenades going off. Glass is flying. It's a little bit chaotic. You know, Clausewitz speaks of the fog of war. You're kind of trying to figure out what's going on, and all of a sudden he reached up to his stomach, didn't know what he was doing, and McKinney shot him three times. I'd never seen a man shot close. When you see something like that in the movies, it looks glamorous, it looks cool. When you see it out in real life and you see blood coming out of somebody's mouth and you watch them die, it affects you. And that was the first taste of combat, you know. And I never forget, Mac looked over after, you know, it took about 20 minutes for the guy to die, and he said, "Chuck." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You praying?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You're more religious than me." And that kind of bothered me. I knew right then I was backslidden. I wasn't in church. But to a guy like Mac, it mattered to him that I prayed. And I never forgot that men in combat, they'll look to others that they believe talk to God. Hours after that, we ended up called up to go hit the La Comandancia. They had repelled 5th Mech. They had shot some helicopters down. We ended up moving on foot. It turned very kind of chaotic. We got up. We stacked on a building. I was an M60 machine gunner. You don't lead into a building with an M60 machine gun. But we were short. It was probably a battalion-sized mission. We're doing it with 2 platoons. You're basically attacking their White House. And there was a squad in front, and all of a sudden, the vision just went out. Lights went out. Life was kind of gone for a second. An explosion had happened, and when my hearing started to come back and my eyes started to focus, I saw a good friend of mine, Mike Taylor. He had blood just shooting out of his face. There was just mayhem. People were all over the ground. They're bleeding. They're screaming. A grenade had hit the front squad. I turned around. I looked at Mac, and he just nodded his head, and that's all I needed. And I was the first U.S. soldier through the front door. We went through running cyclic with an M60. We got a foothold. We brought the rest of the platoon and began to fight. Now, when I tell that story, when Don Purdy said, "No man, any man that likes combat, sick," and I will tell you, I can't say that I liked what happened right there. It's a sickening thing to see your fellow soldier wounded. It's a sickening thing to see the enemy. But there's something inside of me that says if that's happening in anywhere in the world today, if a U.S. soldier is about to go through the front door of a building, I'm old, I'm getting out of shape, I'm beat up, I would like to be the number one guy. Because I think I'm good at it. It may sound like I'm bragging, but I think I react well. And I think these guys, that when I read this, I said, that's what they are. That's who they are, and that's why I like them. I'm not to their level. I'm not as good as them, but that's just who I am. Some uniqueness about them, when I look at firemen, military, special force, that these guys are special in that they volunteered for it. They're also special in that they're tested. You don't just become the chief of police. Chief Het has gone through a lot of tests. He's proved himself, and he's in a job he wants to do. You're a volunteer. Rangers, SEALs, infantrymen, there's a testing, there's a maintaining a level of fitness. There's also staying proficient with your arms, with your equipment. I love to teach tactical shooting, and I like when civilians want to be good at it also. But I don't like fake tough guy stuff. I don't, you know, the guys that collect all the different various guns and they brag and they talk. I'd rather see a guy who's got one and he's real good at it. And when I used to train it, you know, I could just look at a man, and when you see a guy come out of the holster straight forward, when you see the mags, and everything is a straight line movement. He's drilled. He's good. There's something about that appeals to me, and that's who these guys are. Okay, when I was a major, I had to go to the Command and General Staff College, and academics has never been my thing. I remember the first writing assignment, they said, read Gates's speech on Somalia, read the U.S. policy concerning Somalia, compare and contrast, and talk about the ends, ways, means. And I was like, what in the world does that even mean? And I got an F. I had to write the thing over. That's just not my forte. But very early in the Command and General Staff College, we took a class on critical thinking. And it was kind of a new concept to me that I'm very conservative, I'm very right-wing, I'm very Bible-based, I'm very the Constitution, the oath, that, hey, when you get a problem, when you get a thing, try to look at it from the opposite side. Turn it upside down. Go in circles around it. Study it. Study it mathematically, scientifically. And that kind of sunk into my head, and I think it matured me a little bit where I tried to start looking at things at a different angle. And I said, I'm not a Bible scholar. I didn't go to Bible school. But as I began to study Bible, I began to see that I had, you know, some of my own weaknesses That there are things that, if this makes sense, that are in the Bible but not biblical. To just say somebody did something in the Bible doesn't make it biblical. Going to a fortune teller is not biblical. But King Saul did it. Why? Because King Saul went to a fortune teller. Passing your wife off as your sister to save your own hide is something that Abraham did, but that's not biblical. He did it in the Bible. That, for me, when I began to study, I was like, hey, there's things in the Bible that I might really like or really appeal to me that don't mean it's biblical. And I kind of wanted to look at, you know, even things that were very important. I'm going to read a quote here that I think is interesting. First, I'm going to say there's a uniqueness to the Army uniform. And I have a uniform. How's my uniform look? The colonel's looks better over there. And here's why I bring up the uniform, especially the dress uniform. What occupation in life do you take your accomplishments and hang them on your clothing? It's kind of unique. I mean, police to a small degree, but military to a super high degree. I mean, there's a lot of shiny, gaudy, just stuff on a military uniform. And we're unique. I mean, the plumber doesn't have a little golden toilet with how many times he's fixed, The preacher doesn't have a little baptismal and, you know, hash marks for every baptism. And we're unique that we put our accomplishments and we show them off. Napoleon said, give me enough medals and I'll win you any war. What does that mean? I mean, why did he say, he didn't say give me more ammunition. He didn't say give me cannons. He didn't say give me a newer model of the M4. He said give me enough medals. A soldier will fight long and hard for a bit of colored ribbon. This right here, you know, a little colored ribbon. Why does a soldier fight hard for a colored ribbon? What makes us unique? I would believe if you took those that know me best, if you take my brother Joe, you take my mom, you take her husband Glenn, you take those people that know me and have known me my whole life, know me now, and you say, write 5 words down that will describe Charlie Pudell, good and bad. The word arrogant very well may end up on there. Arrogant? I was told that not too long ago. You're arrogant. I'm not arrogant. I'm good. Yeah. I'm arrogant. Good at what I do. There is a level of arrogance to the soldier. There's a level of arrogance to the guy that wants to do this for 20 to 30 years. There's a level of arrogance to a guy that wants to fight competitively and be recognized, that wants to get the trophy. You still have to earn. You still have to work hard. But there is a level of arrogance to wearing a uniform that, you know, looks like Liddy ate Skittles and threw up on the side of my shirt. You know, it's all colored and shiny. I got in my note, pick on Pastor Rich. It's my little reminder here. I think Pastor Rich is a competitive guy. What I know from him, if I played him in golf, if I played him in whatever we do, we're going to compete. You went to the Philippines not too long ago. I love the Filipino people. I met a lot of Filipinos in Saudi. That's not part of the message. But the Filipino Christian people are an amazing, proud. It was interesting in Saudi. I had to get I started going through all the medical to get ready for retirement, and it was a Filipino nurse. A lot of their nurses are Filipino, and she's taping all these things to my head, and she's just making small talk. Where do your kids go to school? Do you have to pay for education? Well, my kids go to a Christian school. Why do they go to Christian school? Well, I explained to her. She said, and I said, I'm a born-again Christian, and she stopped. She walked around in front of me. She had the biggest smile, and she held her hand out. She told me her first name. She said, I am your sister, and they were just like a crowd Christian people. Had nothing to do with the message, but I'd like to pass that on. So he went to the Philippines. You flew there.
Yes, sir.
And you landed.
Yes, sir.
You had to go through baggage.
Yes.
Okay, all this. So if we like to outdo each other, if he was telling a story and like, yeah, I flew there, I could say, hey, I flew to Panama once, but I didn't land. I hurled myself at 500 feet into a 140-mile-per-hour wind, land feet, knees, and face on an asphalt runway. And I have, it's pretty unique, this little tiny star on the jump wings. We call it the mustard stain. It's a combat star. It's not everybody has jumped out of an airplane. Very few people in the military have actually jumped into combat. So it would be something I could be boastful or brag or even a military. People, hey, man, he's got a mustard stain. When you get any of these awards, you generally go to an award ceremony, and there's somebody that posts the orders, and it's, you know, for gallantry, and we go through this. Why I bring this up is let's fast forward. Let's go as far forward as you can to the real award ceremony. There is one. It's called the Judgment Seat of Christ. And, you know, when I try to look at my own arrogance, you know, 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that, be good or bad. I don't know how that operates. I don't know when we're there. Will it be every Christian from the beginning to the end? Will it be time-phased? I don't know. But we will be rewarded for that which we did. The mustard stain will get me nothing. If the God that created the universe is standing on high, and he points to Pastor Rich, and he talks about his trip to the Philippines. Did anybody get saved while you were there? If one person got saved, and if God can ask, he landed. He went through customs. He didn't do anything fancy. Did a person get saved? Did one soul get spared from hell? You can say yes. And I don't know if he can call on that person and say, did anybody from your life, from your testimony, did they get saved? And did anybody from theirs, does it branch out to like almost what you would call an asymptotic curve? Nobody got saved from me falling out of an airplane and bouncing off the ground and running through airports and La Comandancia and all that. It's a cool story to brag about or to talk about combat. But when I begin to look at what really matters, telling somebody about Jesus matters a whole lot more than combat. I got to Saudi Arabia. The army sent out the policy that we're now going to have openly serving transgender. I had fought a fight. I had wrote an email that went to over 200 people on that same LGBT. I'd like to end in my career. I want to thank this church, too. I was going to do that up front. This church prayed for me. At probably one of the darkest and hardest times of my life. And I also say if you're young, I like to always do learning lessons. If you ever step off in a spiritual fight, and I wrote an email that kind of questioned a policy that said we would give free leave to a soldier getting a gay marriage. And I wrote why I didn't agree with that on religious and kind of scientific grounds. I hit reply all, went to over 200 people, and within an hour they called me up and said, you're fired. I got a general officer letter reprimand that I had to fight. It was going to end my career. Ended up, you know, General Boykin, the 3-star that you see on Fox News quite a bit, he supplied me with a lawyer. But this church was praying for me. It meant a lot. But the point I want to make, if you're young and you step into a fight like that, you don't go it alone. You better have a whole lot of prayer behind you, and you better have the pastor of your church. When I wrote that email and I sent it, I did it alone. And I didn't go prepared with the amount of prayer, with the amount of men behind me praying. And it created for some dark times. It created for some lonely times. But I'll never forget probably one of the hardest times I was having. I became afraid. I'm usually not a fearful person. Became afraid because the lawyer said, you're going to be in the media. They're going to attack you. They're going to attack your family. And I was actually sitting in church, and I got a text. It was on a Wednesday night, and my brother Joe sent me a text. And it was a picture of men up on this actual podium up around here praying for me. And that was one of the most humbling things in my life. I'm not an emotional person, but Lily, it made me emotional right there. But I got to the end of my career, and I started leaning hard on my brother Jeff. He's my youngest brother. He did 20 years, and he did a lot more combat than me. He did five years. He spent his entire career in 18th Airborne Corps. He never had a job like I had, teaching at West Point or OCS. He was in go-to-war units, and he did it 5 times. I think it kind of beat him up. But I started leaning on him, and I said, you know, one of the things I'm disappointed in, I didn't accomplish all that I wanted to accomplish. I never had that Tet Offensive, Battle of the Bulge type moment. He goes, you know, I understand that. But when I began looking, at this career is done. I mean, 30 years went by in a blink of an eye, and I will, for the rest of my life, have the title Lieutenant Colonel Pudell. And I mean, I guess that's kind of cool. I would rather have occupation of Private Pudell than title Lieutenant Colonel Pudell. It's not the title that I wanted. It's the occupation. I'm not a door kicker anymore. I work for a logistics company answering angry truck drivers. You know, that's not fun. You know, probably going to look to teach school later on, but it was kind of a hard struggle to say, I've been doing this for 30 years and it's over. But as I struggled with that, I opened my Bible and I went back to the Mighty Men because it's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. And I began to relook it, to kind of restudy it, and kind of look at who these guys are and why they appealed to me so much. I'm going to read a verse, Ephesians 2:5. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself, that he might be sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. Husbands, love your wives. So when I came back from Saudi, my wife, in no uncertain terms, told me, I'm done. I'm done with these deployments. I was thinking about throwing my retirement packet out and going back. I wanted to go back to Afghanistan. She said, I'm done with the deployments. I'm tired. I've done 5 years with you gone. Something that's not easy to say, my daughters grew up in Christian school. They grew up in church. I was very proud. My oldest daughter graduated high school at 15. She was in college by 16. She was in a courtship with a missionary son from my church. And I went home, and she was with child. And that was not something that I was expecting to deal with. And that was a hard time. And I started looking at my family, and I looked at, you know, all the deployments and all the sacrifice my wife had made, all the sacrifice my children had made. It really made me look internally when I was looking at the situation with my daughter. And I looked at that verse, and I can't lie, Uriah was literally just a hero to me. The way Uriah was mentioned as one of those mighty men, the way that he would not go home and be with his own wife, he slept on the front steps of the palace because of what the soldiers were experiencing in the field. And it always struck me that when David sent the letter with him to give to Joab, send him to the hottest part of the battle, send him where the battle is the most fierce, and retire from him. Well, when you retreated, there was either a waving of a flag, a blowing of a bugle. There's something that signifies you're retreating. Uriah didn't retreat. Uriah was a warrior, and he was the type that when you put the enemy in front of him, he's going after the enemy. He's got a pit bull type tenacity. He's going to sink his teeth in the side of its face, and he's Shannon McKinney. He's a Delta Force. But I thought back on that deal where they said he sat on the front steps, and we talked about earlier that if his wife could be seen by the king, he lives close. And if Jesus told us, you know, love your wives, or if the Bible tells us love your wives as Christ loved the church, and he had a chance to walk 100 yards and see his wife, what was his wife going through in a day in which combat was with a sword? It's up front, it's close, and people die, and they die a violent death. What were her thoughts if she would know, my husband was 100 yards away, and he never came and saw me? It would be the equivalent if Mike Ferriter was a two-star. I knew him personally, considered him a friend. If he would have called me back from Afghanistan, he'd actually sent me some emails. Tell me what's going on in Afghanistan. How can we better the infantry school at Fort Benning? Well, if they would have brought me back to Fort Benning, if he said, hey, Chuck, you got 3 days, and we're going to fly you back. If I really said, I'm going to sleep on the front steps of Building 4, the headquarters. I'm not going to go just across the border and see my wife. How would she feel about that? And I kind of came to a conclusion. I don't know, like I said, if it's biblical for me to say, but I think Uriah is just an awesome warrior. I think he's got character, but I don't necessarily think he's a good husband. You know, I started looking at the rest of the mighty men, and I said, you know, there were the mighty men of David. They didn't list them as the mighty men of God. Not that they couldn't be. Not that they weren't spiritual men. Not that they weren't men of prayer. But they were known in this chapter as just absolute warriors. They killed a lot of people. They killed one of them 800 men. That's a lot of people to kill. You know, what do they do when they're done? What does Benaiah become when he retires? Is he a marriage counselor? Is he equipped to do that? He's killed a lot of people, and I don't think I have PTSD. I've never thought a bit. But you see things that never leave you. These men saw beyond what I could ever imagine. They see up front and close, sticking a sword in a fellow man. It's vile and it's violent. You know, I know tactics a little bit. Why do you go down into a pit and kill a lion? What tactical advantage does that give you as a military? I almost wonder if there's not a little bit of bravado mixed in with these guys, you know. Somebody asked me once, I wiped out a special ops motorcycle, and I said I was in fifth gear. And he said, why were you in fifth gear? I said, because it didn't have a six, you know. That kind of thrill-seeker bravado lifestyle, you know, made me like these men. But when I look and see at all the sermons Jesus preached, how many times did Jesus ever mention Uriah, Benaiah, Eleazar? He didn't mention these men. He mentioned a lot of other men. So I talked a little bit about police. We talked a lot about military. Kind of what I want to close with is the one group I didn't talk about is firemen, and it's probably the group I know least about. But to actually go into a house or a building that's on fire is not natural. It's like going to a firefight. Natural men don't run to the firefight. They run away from it. It takes training. And I think, like I said, I don't know if it's genetic. It's just a weirdism. There's certain people like us that just like to fight. It's not natural for the fireman to go into the fire. Fire is a fearful thing. Is there a fire truck out front? Well, if there is, if there's a fire truck out front and there's firemen, I would bet you, if you tell these firemen, when you leave this church, there's an address. It's here in Jackson. There's a house on fire. You got to go there and you're going to use the tools of your trade, your ladders, your fire hoses, your axes, and you have to go in there and there's a three-year-old trapped in a room. You have to save them. Do you think that scares them? I don't think it does. I don't think it scares them that much because it doesn't really scare me that much to go to combat. And I'm not saying that being brave. It's something, there's an adrenaline rush to it, but there's a thing about it that's appealing to certain men. Benaiah was not afraid to go into a pit and kill a lion. I don't think he was. I think Benaiah looked for that opportunity. He was a warrior, and he liked to fight. If I told the same fireman, you're going to ride with Pastor Rich, he's going to go up to a house, and when you stop at that house, you're going to go up, you're going to knock on the door, and you're going to tell the people that live in that house, you were born a sinner. If you don't see Jesus as the only way to heaven, if you don't accept the sacrifice that he made on the cross, you're going to die and go to hell. I don't know about the fireman. I know me. That is a scarier thing to do than to go into combat. It is the harder and the scarier thing to me is to tell a fellow person you'll die and to tell people about, to tell a person about Jesus. I think if you look at the disciples, you may have a different opinion than me. If you ask the average person, who was the physically toughest of the 12 disciples? I think Peter, generally, of the original that went with Jesus, Peter was a physical man. When they showed up to arrest Jesus, he pulled a sword out and cut an ear off. I don't think Peter was scared. I think Peter was a physically tough. There was a time when they were fishing, they had all the fish in the nets, and they couldn't get them in, and Peter himself grabbed the nets and drug them to shore. He was a more aggressive as a human being. But when he sat at the fireside and denied Jesus, I don't think he denied him because of physical fear. I think it was more the intellectual. It was more the, it takes to me more courage to be a bold, speak the truth Christian than to go kick doors with bad guys. So while I greatly appreciate when people tell me, thank you for your service, I think me and Chief Het and a lot of others that have migrated to these kind of professions, I don't think we're any more heroes than the nurse that works in the cancer ward, than the Sunday school teacher that teaches small children, than the Uncle Fran, the Bible man. I think they're just as much heroes, and we don't generally look at them, and we don't generally thank them for their service. I spent 29 years doing a job I absolutely love. There is no other occupation, there's no other group out there that would pay me the money the Army paid me, take care of me the way the Army took care of me, give me the retirement, to do the things I did. I mean, everything from being a competitive shooter to Army. So when you thank you for your service, it's almost like you're thanking a quarterback in the NFL. Thank you for your service. Like, man, this is the greatest job ever. I get to play football, and I love football. And I'm not deserving of it. That if you're going to thank people, I want to thank those that were drafted, that were called up, not that picked it as a life experience. And I also think the person that we need to thank the most is the women and the children that have sacrificed while their husbands are off being Benaiah, Uriah, and killing bad guys, when that's kind of what they wanted to do anyway. Thanks again, and I hope all you have a great day.